is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 27, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. A major attack on Fallujah is expected by US troops, while a lawsuit is filed against Donald Rumsfeld for detainee torture. In Australia, local police get sweeping new powers. And in this country, local police participate in a sweep that arrests over 24 undocumented workers. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Texas executed the 18th prisoner of 2004 last night, despite pleas by relatives of the murder victim to spare his life. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
Dominique Green was pronounced dead at 8 p.m. Tuesday, 2 hours later than planned. His execution for the 1992 robbery and murder of Andrew Lestrop Jr. was temporarily halted earlier in the day when a federal judge granted him a reprieve. State attorneys immediately appealed the reprieve to the U.S. Fifth Circuit, where it was overturned and later denied by the U.S. Supreme Court. While Texas pushed for Green's execution, family members of the murder victim requested his life be spared. The governor denied a request from two sons of the victim, Andrew and Andre, to spare Green's life. The state's Board of Pardons and Parole refused to meet with them when considering Green's case. While admitting they had no legal significance, Green's attorney, David Dow, said the state was hypocritical for refusing to acknowledge the victim's pleas.
When the victim's family wants an execution, the state says, well, we need the execution so that the victim's family can get closure. And when the victim's family doesn't want an execution, the state says, well, the view of the victim's family is irrelevant.
From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
With the election just 6 days away, President Bush has received official support from a bipartisan group representing a wide range of Hispanic organizations. Katie Murray is in Washington, D.C.
Today, the board of directors of the Latino Coalition, along with over 20 other Hispanic organizations, announced their endorsement for the re-election of President George W. Bush. President of the coalition, Robert Desposada, said traditionally Hispanics vote democratically, but this race will be very competitive because they will take a more nonpartisan look at the candidates.
What you're seeing this time is that most Hispanic voters are really pushing aside the partisan labels and trying to identify what each individual candidate is offering them.
According to the coalition, John Kerry has not given enough assistance in reforms for the U.S. immigration system, reforms for education, or in helping uninsured workers get access to affordable health insurance. Desposada said Kerry has also been inconsistent with his policies. According to Desposada, Bush, on the other hand, has received Hispanic support through his implementation of programs such as No Child Left Behind and his action to double the funding for community health centers. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Katie Murray.
A prominent human rights group is decrying the use of rape as a tool of war in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Rupert Cook has the story.
Human rights watchdog Amnesty International has called on the international community and the transitional government in the Democratic Republic of the Congo to act against massive levels of sexual violence in eastern Congo. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of women and children have been raped in the east of the country. Sexual violence continues to be used as a weapon of war in the ongoing conflict as rival militias terrorize the local population. Amnesty International reports that many women are subjected to sexual torture and slavery. Widespread rape has also caused an upsurge in the incidence of fistula. Eastern Congo has one of the worst rates in the world for maternal mortality. It's estimated that 20 to 30% of rape victims are HIV positive. Virtually none have access to basic medicines. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook.
An independent investigative BBC journalist is accusing Republican Party officials in Florida of creating lists of predominantly African American voters to use for potential challenges to their voting rights on Election Day. Randy Zimmerman reports from Tampa.
According to Greg Pallast, someone inside the Bush campaign headquarters created a so-called caging list of 1,886 names of residents from mostly black and traditionally Democratic areas of Jacksonville. The list was then emailed to the executive director of the Bush campaign in Florida and the campaign's national research director in Washington, D.C. Republican Party of Florida spokesperson Mindy Tucker Fletcher wrote to the BBC and said Pallast's information was incomplete. For example, she said, caging is a commonly used term to describe opening a large amount of mail and logging it into a database. Fletcher added that the list sent to Republican Party officials was created to collect returned mail. Leon County Supervisor of Elections Ion Sancho, a Democrat, told Palast that the only possible reason why they would keep such a thing is to challenge voters on Election Day. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF in Tampa, I'm Randy Zimmerman.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
British troops have begun moving north from Basra to take up position near Baghdad, freeing up U.S. troops for what is widely expected to be a major assault on the city of Fallujah. Iman Kamis, former director of Occupation Watch, told FSRN earlier today the Iraqi government announced they will not be negotiating with the people of Fallujah.
People are just very tense, waiting for what's going to happen next. Because, I mean, everybody is talking about a major assault or attack on Fallujah. And the bombing the city is going on daily basis, every day. There are families who are killed. I mean, the American announced that they hit a house where Al-Zarqawi people are there. And then it turns out that it's only a family. The same thing in Baghdad. Blasts and clashes and shooting is going on every day. And I think you heard about the Japanese man who was kidnapped yesterday, who I think works with the Japanese forces in Samawa, and the Japanese government refused to do anything about it with the people who kidnapped him.
Iman Kamis, formerly the director of Occupation Watch, she's based in Baghdad. Meanwhile, 6 months after CBS aired photos of detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib in Iraq, Amnesty International today blasted the Bush administration for not conducting a complete independent investigation into torture of detainees. The human rights group says the absence of such a probe will allow for further abuses to occur. In a 200-page report, Amnesty International notes Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld authorized stripping, isolation, hooding, stress positions, and the use of dogs in interrogations. The report also states Rumsfeld authorized the keeping of so-called ghost detainees from the International Committee of the Red Cross. And as Mitch Jeserich reports, lawyers of four former detainees at Guantanamo Bay filed a lawsuit against Rumsfeld and other top officials for the torture detainees faced in Guantanamo as well.
Eric Lewis is an attorney with Bach, Robinson & Lewis, who with the Center for Constitutional Rights filed the first lawsuit brought by released Guantanamo Bay detainees against government officials for torture and illegal detention.
We have today filed suit on behalf of our clients, who are four British nationals, four young men who were detained for more than 2 years without charge in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and subsequently released without any charges having been filed. They've now returned to their homes in the UK, having been branded as international terrorists as they try and recover their lives.
The suit is seeking $10 million in damages from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and senior officers at Guantanamo Bay. Because the suit is not against the government but individuals, the lawyers of the former detainees must prove that Rumsfeld and the others acted outside of government policy. The suit was filed in a D.C. district court, and the lawyers are citing the Alien Tort Claims Act, recently upheld by the Supreme Court, that allows foreign nationals to bring human rights cases to the U.S. courts. Rumsfeld and others are accused of violating the U.S. Constitution, the Geneva Conventions, and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Again, attorney Eric Lewis.
Shafiq Rasool told me that the worst beating he ever had in his whole life was by Marines in Guantanamo on the barge on the way from having just arrived after 20 hours air travel from Afghanistan to Guantanamo. They were savagely beaten on the barge to the prison, where they were told, "You have reached your final destination. You are property of the United States Marines."
The Bush administration argues that detainees at Guantanamo Bay do not qualify for Geneva Accord protections because when caught, they represented no so-called viable government and did not wear an official military uniform. Human rights lawyers say the Geneva Accords protect everyone, everywhere. According to Jamal Al-Harith, one of the four detainees bringing the suit, when captured, he wasn't wearing a uniform or representing anyone. In fact, as the Afghan war began, he was being held prisoner by the Taliban. Robert Lazar is Jamal Al-Harith's attorney.
He fell into the hands of the Taliban and was put in a Taliban prison and was accused of being a British spy. Fortunately, that didn't last long because the Taliban regime failed and fell. And he thought that might be the end of his problems, and was hoping to get repatriated to the United Kingdom. And whilst he was trying to negotiate that, the American authorities, the US, took custody of him, and soon after that he was transported to Guantanamo Bay and remained there from February 2002 until March this year.
A federal judge recently ruled that the government must give three Kuwaitis held at Guantanamo Bay access to lawyers and must allow them to speak to their lawyers in private. The judge cited the Supreme Court decision earlier in the year that detainees at Guantanamo Bay should have access to the federal courts. But Barbara Olshansky from the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is representing several detainees, says the administration is hardly moving to give such access to the prisoners. She says the administration is using the classification of enemy combatant to stall all such procedures at every step.
They're hoping they can take that into federal court and that they'll never actually get a day in federal court. They'll use that, you know, to hit the judge on the head with, and that'll be the end of it. And I think that's what this administration is doing. I think it's directly, like, contemptuous of the Supreme Court, which is astounding to me.
It is believed that there is about 500 detainees still being held in Guantanamo Bay. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Plans are underway for protests following the November 2nd election in case of voter disenfranchisement or fraud. Election irregularities are seen as likely, given problems in the 2000 presidential election, that this race is also extremely close, and because of current reports of suppression efforts in key states. Jenny Johnson reports.
Concerns are growing about the state of the electoral process in the week leading up to what many consider to be the most significant presidential election of their lifetimes.
People around the country are concerned about this election.
Andrea Buffa is in Florida to do get-out-the-vote efforts and election monitoring.
Feel that the 2000 election was stolen, that people's votes weren't counted, and we are absolutely determined to make sure that doesn't happen again. And now people are even more worried because it seems like every single day there are reports from different states about voter disenfranchisement and attempts to prevent people from exercising their voting rights.
Problems are expected on many fronts. One area of difficulty is the deluge of new voter registrations in key states such as Ohio, which has registered thousands of new voters, Pennsylvania, topping 8 million new voters this year, and Florida, which has added more than 1 million new voters since February. Delays are possible in processing registrations. Some registrations have reportedly been thrown out due to technicalities, and allegations of fraud have occurred. At the same time, state election officials in Florida, a state that remains a complete toss-up, are facing lawsuits by the Democratic Party for alleged disenfranchisement-related activities. The Kerry campaign accuses the state of trying to scare away voters, while the Republican Secretary of State charges that the lawsuits are politically motivated attempts to erode public confidence in the system. Republicans have said they expect fraud, intimidation, and lawsuits in an attempt to overturn a Bush victory on Tuesday. The group No Stolen Elections is planning post-November 2nd actions in case of problems during the election. Given the many potential scenarios, the group is planning to be ready for anything. Leslie Kagan, one of the group's directors, describes possible calls to action.
So it might be, for instance, that in some states the vote is very, very, very close. And that part of what we might decide to call for is for people to go out in demonstrations, in marches and rallies and public protest activities, demanding an immediate recount. On the other hand, it might be that we might just send out an alert saying, this is what we know so far. We hope in the next 24 hours to know more, and we'll send you another update. You know, there's so many unknowns here.
The group will rely on other coalitions of monitors across the country for information on irregularities. Together, they will meet to determine if action is needed. The National Project Election Protection Coalition will help provide some of that information. Doug Ramsey, who is organizing the Arizona effort for the coalition, says he is focusing on the election itself.
Our primary focus is to make sure that people get to vote on election day if they're legally registered, to make sure that the same day resolution of the problem. We are collecting this huge database of information, and depending on what that shows, I'm sure there will be some action taken, but I don't think that anybody's anticipating one thing or another right now. You know, we're not anticipating a disaster on Election Day, but we are prepared for whatever happens.
Activists across the country will be looking for any call to action that comes out of the No Stolen Election campaign. Jeff Nolish, an activist in Bowling Green, Ohio, describes the coalition he is confident will act on November 3rd.
People in Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania are emailing me saying that we're in if nothing happens in Pittsburgh. You got all these groups like union organizations and national groups like the League of Pissed Off Voters. This time we're watching. These are helping to facilitate a massive response. You know, inclusive of people like Michael Moore and Jesse Jackson and people to participate as well. Like, it'll be gigantic if something goes down in Ohio.
Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
In Australia, civil rights groups have reacted with concern to proposed counter-terrorism surveillance laws announced by the biggest state, New South Wales, which would hand increased powers to the police to tap people's homes and monitor prisoners' communications. Erica Voles in Sydney has this report.
New South Wales Premier Bob Carr outlined the proposed laws last week, which will allow police to bug people's homes without their knowledge for longer and change the classification for terrorist prisoners so their communications can be monitored. The laws, yet to be tabled in Parliament, have won the support of police and terrorist experts. However, civil libertarians remain concerned about the possible impact of the laws. Cameron Murphy, the President of the New South Wales Council for Civil Liberties.
Look, I'm very concerned about the New South Wales government's proposal. In many ways, it resembles the United States government's powers for sneak and peek warrants to be issued to the FBI. That's been much discredited in the United States.
If passed, the laws will enable police to conduct covert searches and bug homes for up to 90 days, with no requirement to tell the occupant for 6 months. The New South Wales government has claimed that the changes are necessary, as they will give police more time to develop better intelligence about terrorist networks. The former head of security for the Sydney 2000 Olympics, Paul McKinnon, agrees. He claims other states should consider adopting the laws as well. However, civil rights groups maintain that existing laws are strong enough. Cameron Murphy.
There's no evidence at all that these proposed laws are going to assist police in any way to combat terrorism. New South Wales already has the toughest anti-terrorism legislation in the world. What police need to do is to use those tough powers effectively. They should do that before asking for additional powers.
One possible impact of the laws, though, will be a further isolation of Australia's Muslim communities. According to the head of the Australian Muslim Civil Rights Advocacy Network, Waleed Quddus, the combination of new laws, both state and federal, and increased discrimination against Muslims is taking its toll on Australia's Islamic communities.
The net effects of both of these phenomena has been a feeling of paranoia and disenfranchisement.
This feeling is particularly galling for the Muslim community, given that security analysts themselves have recognised that the community is doing its bit to inform the authorities of possible terrorist activities.
The Muslim community is being very cooperative in combating any kind of terrorism, and they've been doing their part, but they still feel like they're being ostracised by things like the National Security Hotline, this continual stream of laws that seems to have an undue impact on them, and they're just becoming more and more isolated, more and more cautious, and less interested in engaging with the rest of the community.
This is Erica Voles in Sydney, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Latino immigrant workers and community allies rallied Tuesday in Woodbridge, Virginia, south of D.C., to denounce the arrest of over 25 of their fellow day laborers. Advocates fear this may be the first application of a new Virginia law that allows local police to act as immigration officers. Darby Hickey of the D.C. Radio Co-op reports.
Every day, dozens of day laborers, mostly immigrants from Mexico and Central America, gather on the lawn of the Covenant Pentecostal Church in Woodbridge, Virginia, waiting for construction contractors to offer them work for the day. The gathering of men is ubiquitous to many communities across the region. Workers at this site say they reached an agreement with local police and the church that they could wait for work on the lawn. Last week, police broke the agreement, arresting 25 day laborers on loitering charges.
Es una trampa perversa.
It's a perverse joke that in this anti-immigrant atmosphere, they shut us out, leaving us without legal status, and then they use that as an excuse to persecute us. We demand the freedom of our comrades in jail.
Libertad a nuestros compañeros trabajadores presos.
Libertad.
Ricardo Juarez is an organizer with Mexicans Without Borders, a group organizing and supporting the workers in Woodbridge. When Juarez and others called for a rally yesterday morning, and over 75 men gathered on the spot where the others had been arrested, the police again appeared and ordered everyone to disperse. David Martinez was one of the men arrested.
The only thing we asked is that they drop the charges against us because we weren't doing anything wrong. We're just good people who come looking for work, to earn money and send it to our families. For example, sometimes contractors come and we work for them, but then they don't pay us. We have to take these risks, and it doesn't help when the police come and harass us.
Under Virginia law HB 570, which was passed this summer, local police are mandated to enforce immigration law on their regular beat. David Martinez says all of the men arrested were transported to an immigration jail, where he says they are interrogated and those with identification papers were allowed to leave after setting a court date. But Martinez and several others were threatened with deportation. Martinez was set free when he produced a ticket for Honduras, but the whereabouts of 7 to 12 others are still unknown. Libertad! Ricardo Juarez says the authorities refused to give further information. Libertad! For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey of the DC Radio Co-op.
Consumer and immigration fraud are becoming more common in immigrant communities. These fraudulent businesses are filling the gaps for much-needed services for immigrants. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, there's a campaign in New York to warn immigrants and crack down on these fraudulent services.
The New York Citizenship Unit began receiving calls several months ago from immigrants. They were asking about a service they heard about.
A nonprofit in Florida that's been calling people in the tri-state area, trying to get them to travel down to Florida, pay a fee of $450.
And they'll receive a social security number and citizenship. This scam alerted the Citizenship Unit to the idea that other immigration and consumer frauds could be running rampant throughout the immigrant community. And they found plenty. They range from work-at-home programs to identity theft to immigration consultation. Luz Tavada Salazar, director of the Citizenship Unit.
They're all focused on immigrants, though. They're all ways in which people take advantage of the immigrant community primarily.
Many immigrants, desperate to find help in navigating the immigration system, turn to businesses that claim to make the process easy. The Citizenship Unit, with New York State Consumer Affairs, launched an ongoing campaign of information sessions and outreach to tell immigrants that they can be ripped off and what they should watch out for.
Buenas noches. Mi nombre es Jamal Givara, y soy un abogado de inmigración.
This information session is held 1/2 mile from Yankee Stadium in a mostly Hispanic community in the South Bronx. Alicia wants to know why a company she never heard of, Provincia, keeps taking her money.
Some people steal my money and my credit card for 3 times in 7 months. That's where I come from.
Tonight, the speakers at the conference are warning of what seems to be a new type of scam, a green card through the diversity visa lottery, which is relevant because of its timing. This year's official application process through the State Department will open November 5th. Some companies on the internet are guaranteeing a green card if you fill out their paperwork and pay them a fee of up to $1,000. Again, Luz.
Not only are they claiming to be able to put in this application for you, but they're promising you a visa, which they cannot do, of course, because it's a process.
In reality, the only way to apply for the diversity lottery is online at the State Department website, and it's free. But the lottery is meant to grant a green card to people of countries that have few immigrants living in the United States. Residents from 15 countries aren't allowed to apply, including mainland China, Mexico, the Dominican Republic, and India. And even if an immigrant does qualify for the application process, only 55,000 green cards are given out of 9 million applicants. If you type in immigration and green card on an internet search engine, dozens of companies appear that could be fraudulent. Right now, the Consumer Protection Board is investigating several of these companies. The word notarios is a common word in Spanish for expert attorney, but when it's translated to English, it has a different meaning.
Often these places say that they're notary publics, and they may very well be a notary public, but here that's just some, you know, someone who would authenticate a signature on a document. In Latin American countries, a notary public actually means an expert attorney. It's a very different meaning. And so they know that and they take advantage and they mislead.
Attorney Jamal Jabaro continues to say that the company skirts around the law by obtaining a notary republic license, but offers legal services. A state law was passed last month that aims to regulate and set standards for businesses offering immigration or legal services. The state will now be allowed to prosecute fraudulent activity. Margaret McHugh, executive director of the New York Immigration Coalition, said this legislation is monumental, but it falls short of what the immigrant community really needs: abundant and affordable legal advice to navigate through the immigration process.
Unless we begin to create more places, honest, competent, low-cost places that people can go for these services, for every time we might fine, someone else simply opens up across the street from them if they get shut down because the demand is so great. So until we do something to meet the legitimate demand for services here, we're really not going to make any progress on this issue, I think.
And as for Alicia, who didn't understand why someone was taking $90 from her every 3 months, she learned that her identity was stolen.
Still my
identity.
Still, that is the problem.
For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Free Speech Radio News commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting from his cell on death row.
I have learned that equality may not mean freedom, and freedom may not mean liberation. You can vote, my friend, and have no democracy. So said Benjamin Zephaniah, a black British poet, in Having a Word. This election may differ from the past dozen or so that has gone before, or it may be strikingly similar. That's because in any given presidential election, roughly half of the eligible electorate even bothers to vote. There are, of course, many reasons for this reticence to participate. But in numerical terms, that means roughly 100 million men and women don't bother. Thus, the major corporate parties split up the other 100 million, and he, it's always a he, isn't it, who garners 51% or more of that slice, gets to keep all the marbles and announce victory. That's an odd notion of democracy, isn't it? That majority really amounts to less than 25% of the national electorate. For example, during the 2000 presidential campaign, Democrat Al Gore received 48,971,067 votes. The Republican candidate, George W. Bush, received 48,779,508 votes. The question is, in this nation that boasts of its mission to spread democracy, why are there so few folks who vote? Since 1968, the Humphrey-Nixon race, there has not been a presidential election where over 60% of the voting age population participated. In fact, even then, in 68, it was 60.9%. It seems that simple cynicism must play some part in this process. People have little trust in politicians. Some of this is undoubtedly a reaction to the Watergate scandals of the early 70s, but that can't explain it all. There are millions of young folks for whom 1973 is ancient history, and we might as well be referring to the Civil War. For them, as well as many older folks, the prospect of voting is a losing gambit. They feel, with some justification, that there is little or nothing to vote for. In the name of a democracy, many countries empower what one British critic has called an elective dictatorship. For Free Speech Radio News, from Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.